across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio. This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to VeteransRadio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to nvbdc.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. We want to welcome back to Veterans Radio today Vice Admiral Kevin Green, United States Navy retired. We're going to talk about the fleet structure and issues related to that, and then we're also going to get into talking about the Navy's recruiting issue and how that impacts all these other decisions. But let me set this up a little bit. Kevin Green went to Annapolis in 1971, and about 30 years later, 30 plus years of military service, retired as a vice admiral, has been very active in all things defense and Navy since then, both in the private government, private corporation world, as well as government affairs, and stays very attuned to things. He commanded the USS Abraham Lincoln carrier group when he was active duty, and I think his last assignment was deputy chief of naval operations plans and policy before his retirement. Admiral, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, we spoke before about something that's going on, which is NATO's 75th anniversary, and we got done, and I said, hey, Admiral, I got some more questions for you, and you were gracious enough to say, yeah, we should talk about that. And so really what we want to talk about, it starts with acknowledging some of the challenges that the United States has in its national security around the world on the high seas. And that leads you into thinking about, well, what's the right Navy force structure? What are the plans that we have to have in place? So why don't you recap a little bit about what the Navy looks at in terms of strategic concerns on the oceans around the world?
Certainly, and the foundation of all of that is a description of the missions of the Navy. Why do we have a Navy in the first place, and what does the Navy do for the country? More than 50 years ago, the Chief of Naval Operations, the Senior Admiral of the Navy, laid out four basic missions for the Navy. One of them, strategic deterrence. Principally through our strategic submarine force. The next was sea control, maintaining control of the seas, projection of power ashore with our partners, the United States Marine Corps, and the Army to be complete, and naval presence around the world. And by missions, what we're talking about are the outputs of the objectives of having a Navy in the first place. Recently, the current Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Franchetti, answered the question publicly when asked, what does the Navy do? And the Navy is here to preserve the peace, to respond in a crisis, and to win decisively in wars. The Navy operates far forward around the world and around the clock. from the seabed to space and cyberspace and in the information environment, promoting our nation's prosperity and security, deterring aggression, and providing options to our nation's leaders. We deliver power for peace and are always postured and ready to fight and win as part of a joint force that is with the other U.S. military services and alongside our allies and partners. The headquarters of the Navy is focused on organizing, training, and equipping the Navy in order to carry out the missions that are assigned by the combatant commanders. The geographic combatant commanders run various sections of the globe, and we, along with the other services, provide the forces that allow them to carry out their peacetime and their wartime missions. So what we do is a really important part of that. And when we start thinking hard about the force structure, the size of the fleet, one measure is the total number of battle force ships. Today, there are 293 battle force ships, meaning what you would think of as warships, aircraft carriers, amphibious assault ships, destroyers, cruisers, frigates, littoral combat ships, and so forth. 293 of them altogether, when we also count the military sealift command ships, the ships that provide the logistics support for that battle force.
When you put that in context, give us some indication of the, I don't know, I think most people don't understand how old the fleet is, maybe how long a ship is good for until it has to be replaced. Help the uninformed get a better idea of, is 293 all you need? Or how does replacement and those sorts of things come into play?
Sure. Well, it is a fact that things that humans build don't generally last forever. And that's certainly true of ships and aircraft that operate in the complex, demanding, and very, very difficult environment of the sea, of the oceans of the world, and the littoral areas, that is, the parts of the ocean that are close to land. Typically, we like to keep a ship for 30 to 40 years. We have an average age on our fleet today of about 24 years, and that includes submarines, the aircraft carriers, and the destroyers, cruisers, and littoral combat ships, some of them quite new, but you can tell from that average age of in the mid-20s or so that it is a big challenge. We are constantly building new ships, bringing them out, putting them into commission and operating them in order to carry out these missions that are assigned to us. You mentioned, or you asked, if 293 was the right number. Well, the day I entered the Naval Academy in the 1960s, we had almost 1,000 ships in the Navy, in the fleet. Now, a lot of them were frankly speaking, relics from World War II. Others were relatively new ships. They had different kinds of missions, and they were nowhere near as capable as the ships we have today. So when we talk about the right size of the ship and how one would compare that with any other ship around the world, it is by consensus in the people who analyze naval forces that the number one, the top, the most powerful fleet in the world today is the United States Navy. There's very little question about that. The Chinese fleet has more holes in the water, but in terms of capability, in terms of missions, in terms of modernization, in terms of the things that really matter in the measure of a ship, we are at the top of the heap. That doesn't give us a heck of a lot of margin, however. And when we talk about potential operations that the Navy might be involved with in the future. We only have to consider the kinds of operations the Navy's involved in today around the world. We look at in the Red Sea, for example, USS Eisenhower, an aircraft carrier strike group, is every day taking out anti-ship missiles that are endangering the sea lanes, endangering merchant ships plying their normal peacetime, innocent travel around the world to provide products and services to the world, the countries of the world. We look at threats to Taiwan and the South China Sea. We look at issues having to do with the Korean Peninsula and concerns there. We look at areas of the globe, believe it or not, there is still a piracy issue around the world, whether it's in the South Asia area or in the Western Pacific, or it's off the coast of Africa, or either in the South Atlantic or in the Indian Ocean. It's a genuine mission that continues. And one of the challenges, one of the concerns we have is even with the exquisitely equipped, crewed, trained, and ready ships that we have in that battle force, a ship can only be in one place at one time. And when there are lots of different challenges around the world, whether it has to do with Eastern Europe, the Black Sea, the Mediterranean, the Pacific, you name it, it is a real challenge satisfying those operational demands of our combatant commanders to provide the fleet forces that are necessary for them to carry out their missions. And I am very sure that if you were to talk with any of those combatant commanders, they would tell you, yes, we can do our mission today, but it's a narrow margin. And I sure wish I had more forces at hand, ships, aircraft, and this pertains to the other military services as well.
Yeah, and what's unique, though, on the Navy mission, though, is you mentioned it, you can only have that ship in one spot, and it takes a long time to transit somewhere else. It's not a matter about jumping on a plane and moving folks by air travel. It's a much slower process, and it's not just the number of ships you have, but the types and the locations where they can be deployed, because you just ran us around the whole world from the Mideast to the South China Sea and everywhere in between. How do you then, how is the country now planning, because a ship has such a long life and a long time to be, it takes to build. How do you plan for the future like that? The ship you launch today is going to be around for 35 years. How do you think about what it's actually going to be used for over that 35-year period?
Well, that's a great question, Jim, and it's the center of why the National Defense Strategy is so important. The National Defense Strategy anticipates developments around the world make a big difference in the planning for structure, meaning how many people do we need to have on active duty, how many aircraft, how many ships, how much ammunition, how many systems, how do we tie all of those things together electronically in the sense of sharing information and intelligence and all of that. Keeping in mind that while we're doing our planning, our potential adversaries are doing the same. They are designing and building their forces, naval forces, military, air forces, space, and certainly cyber forces, to overcome the strengths that we have today. And our national military strategy leans forward on that. What do we have to be able to do to maintain our current advantages and avoid a situation where we're outgunned, we're outnumbered, and we've run out of ideas? We have got to create the warfighting advantages, and that will dictate what we need to build and what we need to invest in. And while we're doing that, one of the issues that is a controlling factor is the defense industrial sector, what can our private sector companies, our industry partners, and academia do to help us move forward? And I have to tell you that when we look at a battle force of 293 ships, not all of those ships are available all the time. They're going through maintenance. Nuclear-propelled ships go through periodic nuclear refueling, which takes a long time to get completed. It's expensive as well. The capacity of shipyards, both federal shipyards, and there are a few of those left, but commercial shipyards where the ships are built, where the ships are maintained, and the other industrial firms that provide maintenance and provide the systems, the armaments, the munitions, and the other systems they need. It's a big challenge. So the question at this point comes, well, what are we going to do about all this? Looking at what the military leadership and what the senior folks in Congress and what the administration are dealing with, number one thing for them to keep in mind, and they do, is that the threats to our nation and our interests around the world are real and they're growing. It's a changing strategic environment. We've got to be able to defend the homeland. We've got to be able to deter strategic attack, and we've got to be able to deter potential adversaries from moving against us and be prepared to prevail in the event of a strategic attack, or in the event of any conflict with any of the host of potential adversaries that are out there.
Well, you said one of the four pillars here of the mission is strategic deterrence, and you can't have strategic deterrence if your adversaries say, well, their fleet continues to erode and get older and they're not replacing it fast enough. We just have to wait them out 10 years and we'll have the advantage because there isn't strategic deterrence. So I was reading in preparation to talking to you the Congressional Research Service's white paper on March 1st, 2024 on the Navy force structure and shipbuilding plans, and they say, well, we're going to build 11 ships per year for 35 years, and that'll get us up to something like 355 ships. And my first reaction was, oh my God, 35 years to get up to that number? Again, I have just a general layman's view of this thing. When you look at those kind of projections, and again, we're talking to retired Vice Admiral Kevin Green, who was the Deputy Chief Naval Operations Plans and Policy Director at one point, how do you look at those sort of plans and say, well, here's a 35-year plan, we'll try to build 11 a year?
Well, I'll tell you, Jim, it worries me. And I'm not alone. And we have put ourselves in a situation where in the short term, we have to focus on readiness. Readiness of the force, the platforms, that is the ships, aircraft, and other systems that we use. But ensuring that when they deploy, when they leave port to go over and carry out an operational mission, they are ready. They are trained, they are well armed, the systems work, they have the spares and the materials and the ammo that they need to get the job done. That doesn't solve the longer term problem, but it solves the immediate problem when we're able to get enough of them out there. There's been a lot of focus in the past several years on how many of this battle force, how many of the battle force ships are fully ready for mission. In the aviation world, they refer to that measure as full mission capable, and the FMC rates, full mission capability rates of the Naval Air Force has gone up significantly in the last several years due to investments and better means of managing that force. They've done a great job, and they have to stay on it. One of the things that occurs to me is this relationship with the defense industrial base and expanding the defense industrial base and finding things like disruptive capabilities the things that we haven't had in the past, things that, that make a difference. The Secretary of the Navy has put together a new disruptive capabilities office that is looking at just that. And they're principally looking at things like cyber warfare and use of drones and all that. I have observed, I have seen and been present at demonstrations from a lot of different companies, companies that are not traditional defense firms that are applying new technologies to things that sound awfully mundane, things like propulsion systems. I saw a demo recently of a new kind of propulsion system for assault craft, amphibious craft, and so forth, that is so different from what's been used before. And finding a way of connecting the government, the Department of Defense, and the folks who do the acquisition of new systems, to connect them with the companies. I mean, this is good old American know-how and inventiveness and energy, and brilliant new thoughts, and you, being able to connect all of this together.
You really have to count on some of that to stay up with folks, countries who may be spending more money and attempting to leapfrog you in just numbers of ships at sea. You have to try to move forward with some technologies, this disruptive capabilities you mentioned. And that's one of the ones I wanted you to expand on a little bit, because the Navy's planning on actually quite a number of larger unmanned underwater vehicles for a variety of work and missions over the next couple of decades, and maybe moving that number up to, like, I think I read 150. Again, help us who aren't in this regularly to think about, what does that do? How does that help your capabilities?
Well, first of all, back to that earlier point that one ship can only be in one place at a time. The Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf, in the Northern Indian Ocean, and the Red Sea, has for years now been engaged in a brilliantly successful and extremely innovative program to use unmanned systems, platforms, principally surface-based boats, if you will, aircraft also, to be able to expand their ability to conduct surveillance and intelligence gathering. That's been true in the Fourth Fleet area of responsibility as well, in the Caribbean and around South America and Central America. They're able to use these systems in a theater where it's hard to get a large number of ships and aircraft, because it's a very large area and there's lots of work to be done. But being able to use those kinds of systems is extraordinarily powerful. Admiral Paparo, who's the commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet now and has been confirmed by the Senate to be the next commander of the Indo-Pacific Command later this year, has made a number of public statements concerning the use of thousands of such unmanned systems, subsurface, surface, and aerial, to be able to, again, expand his ability to gain intelligence, conduct surveillance, and in some cases, they can have other kinetic missions as well. It's a very exciting change, and it requires fewer people to be placed, at the scene of action, if you will. Some of these platforms have extraordinary endurance. They can go out for periods of time. We've done a number of fleet exercises in the last year and a half or so that have demonstrated the value to the fighting force of what these platforms can do.
Well, it's really interesting, and I think in a very positive way for national security, Admiral. And while I also am very worried that we don't either have the congressional budget for or the defense industrial base to build more ships at a more rapid pace than we need, I don't want to end this on a downer. I really want to come back and say, one of the things that I think is also going on in recognition of what some of our adversaries are doing is a greater effort to have naval partners, and I'm thinking of Australia in particular, but I suspect this goes on worldwide, that the U.S. Navy is working hard to have naval partners in other countries sort of as a force multiplier and a strategic deterrent. Can you advise us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And, you know, you and I were speaking last week about things. I mentioned that I served on a German ship back in my midshipman days. Ships that I served on as a commissioned officer had exchange officers and others, and we operated with NATO ships and with Japanese ships and with Korean ships and others as well. Today, the British, the French, the Germans, members of NATO, you know, countries in Europe, are already engaged in planning and continuing a series of operations of their ships in the Western Pacific because of their understanding that if there's a serious problem somewhere in the globe, it's going to affect the entire globe. And that's a very, very encouraging and positive development. And I have to say that, once again, the strength of our national abilities is not dependent on us alone. We have great partners who've been proven in combat, who have made it very clear where their loyalties lie, and we couldn't be more fortunate than to have the friends that we do. And typically, the adversaries that we consider for potential concern in the future don't have that luxury of having strong, capable friends to be able to help them out. You mentioned one last thing on the defense industrial base. The shipyards that they operate are so important to us. Their workforces are important as well. And I'll tell you what, that's tough work, working in a shipyard. It's extraordinarily rewarding. The skills and talents take years to develop, and there can't be a more satisfying career for someone with an industrial bent than to work in one of our commercial shipyards in the United States.
They're such important work. You're right. We're talking with Vice Admiral Kevin P. Green, retired United States Navy, and we've been talking about fleet structure and some of the challenges the Navy faces on a national security front around the world. And we really appreciate his time on this subject.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows
by visiting us at veteransradio.org. That's veteransradio.org.
And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We again want to thank our national sponsors, the National Veterans Business Development Council, NVBDC.org, VA Ann Arbor Health Care System, the Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter, Ann Arbor, Michigan, VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423 in Ann Arbor, and the American Legion Press Corps Post 46, also in Ann Arbor. We appreciate all your support. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsor level, and continue to support keeping Veterans Radio on the air. And until next time, you are dismissed.